Rules are rules, he says in his characteristically flat, emotionless German. I obviously have no idea what his voice actually sounded like, but I would bet it was flat and emotionless. If something is wrong, it's wrong. If everyone could pick and choose her own rules to follow, the world would be lawless. Keine Ausreden. According to Google Translate, that means no excuses, which I assume is engraved on Kant's tombstone. Moral jaywalking. I'm going to risk the back of my head and disagree with Kant here because of what I think of as the hot day jaywalking rule. Let's say we need to cross the street to get to a store on the other side. The crosswalk is a block south of us. It's 103 degrees, and we just drove here in a car whose interior was 200 degrees, and there's no traffic, so we jaywalk. It's technically a crime, but it's barely a crime, and utterly understandable, and it saves us some misery. Now, would Kant let us do it? No. Categorical imperative, universal maxim, blah, 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 blah. But you know what? Shut up, Kant. It is so hot out here, and we just need to pop into CVS to pick up a prescription. It'll take 2 seconds, and we're sweating buckets, and shut up. We're not perfect. Sue us. In moments of exhaustion, when the act we'd be committing is so infinitesimally bad that it barely even registers as bad, or it's only bad in a fuzzy, complex way, I think it's okay to break these small rules. Now, maybe this sounds self-serving. Maybe I want to make an argument for moral jaywalking, under the right circumstances, just to create a reasonable defense for my decision to walk my Jekyll and Hyde dog without a leash or to not switch banks, which, again, how annoying does that sound? But I don't think it is self-serving. For one thing, as we learn from Susan Wolfe's Moral Saints, and from the case of that annoying guy who allowed his dutifulness to run amok, me, following every rule all the time in all scenarios isn't necessarily even good. In fact, the political scientist James C. Scott actually thinks that breaking a rule every once in a while is morally necessary.
One day, you will be called upon to break a big law in the name of justice and rationality. Everything will depend on it. How are you going to prepare for that day when it really matters? You have to stay in shape, so that when the big day comes, you will be ready. What you need is anarchist calisthenics. Every day or so, break some trivial law that makes no sense, even if it's only jaywalking. Use your own head to judge whether a law is just or reasonable. That way, you'll keep trim. And when the big day comes, you'll be ready.
So for Scott, these small transgressions build up our ethical muscles and prepare us for more important moral exercise. But I also think that some rules are coarse and ineffective ways of achieving a result, like all dogs must be on leashes or pedestrians can never jaywalk. And I further think that if we're trying to be good people, given how exhausting life on Earth can be, taking a little respite from our moral exhaustion is okay and maybe even necessary, just so we don't lose our minds. I say that we allow ourselves these moments of rule breaking on two conditions. First, that the rules we violate are not obviously harmful to other people. Let's say you love animals, you give money to the ASPCA, and you even once pulled your car over to help a turtle that had wandered out into the road. That's right, that was you in that example from earlier. That's how much you love animals. You're also a huge proponent of adopting pets from shelters instead of buying them from breeders. But then one day, a friend tells you that she bought a little yellow lab puppy named Walnut from a breeder, but she's now moving and can't keep it. So yes, adopting Walnut would technically violate your own rule to support adoptions from shelters, but there's a compelling counterargument, which is, oh my God, look at Walnut's ears, they're so floppy. Let yourself off the hook here. Take Walnut home. Jaywalking doesn't negate your entire project of being a good person on Earth, and taking Walnut home doesn't undo the years of work you've put into the cause of promoting shelters. However, if the rule you want to violate is, say, don't flee the scene of an accident, or don't start a war in the Middle East under false pretenses, well, there's no good deed bank account with a high enough balance to excuse your behavior. Second, We need to acknowledge that what we're doing is not ideal. The minimal harm that we generate from this small, bad action could be compounded if we pretend we're not doing it, because that might alter the way that we think of ourselves, and eventually even change what kind of people we are. There's a concept in public policy called the Overton window, named after its inventor, Joseph Overton Window. Just kidding, it's Joseph Overton. An Overton window describes the range of acceptability that a political idea has at any given time. So some ideas, like same-sex marriage, begin as extremely unlikely or even unthinkable. Over time, various factors emerge in the culture: more acceptance of LGBTQ+ people generally, more gay characters on popular TV shows, and the window starts to shift a little bit, making same-sex marriage more politically possible. As cultural norms continue to evolve, younger politicians take office, proponents engage in effective activism, people realize that we all have at least one LGBTQ+ person in our social circle, the Overton window shifts with them until finally the range of possibility described by the window includes same-sex marriage actually being recognized as the law of the land. Something once unthinkable becomes possible, and then eventually it becomes reality. Regarding our little transgressions, we see the potential problem here, right? Overton windows can represent any kind of range, including what we consider acceptable behavior for ourselves. So, we know jaywalking is wrong, but we do it anyway, and then we've become people who occasionally jaywalk. No big deal. But once that's true, it's a short journey to becoming people who always jaywalk. Then one day we can't find a garbage can, and we think, tossing a gum wrapper on the ground isn't that much worse than jaywalking, so we do that. And soon, we're littering all the time. And since littering is now acceptable for us, we start parking illegally, which shifts our window to allow for stiffing contractors out of payment. And once we do that, it's a hop, skip, and a jump to cheating on our taxes, and then embezzling money and cheating on our spouses, and smuggling endangered rhinos out of India, and selling black market weapons to international terrorists. Now, is this likely? No, of course not. That's a deliberately absurd what-if, like one of those cops in a 1980s PSA warning kids that if they smoke a single cigarette, they're on a fast track to heroin addiction. But there's a serious point here. The shifting of an Overton window often happens gradually, and we readjust to its new range very quickly. So there is risk in allowing ourselves to do anything we know is bad just because we want to. When I was writing on the show The Office, the showrunner and my mentor, Greg Daniels, would warn us against jokes that made Michael Scott too cartoonishly stupid. He would cite The Simpsons, which he had written for, saying that in the early days of the show, the staff would write a stupid guy joke for Homer that stretched the amount of stupid that he was. Then they would hesitate and then decide to put it into the episode. Later, someone would pitch another joke that made Homer even stupider, and they would think, he did say that other stupid thing last week, and this isn't that much stupider. And in a matter of a couple of seasons, Homer went from a kind of doofy dad to a guy so dumb he once got his arms stuck in two separate vending machines at the same time. Now, obviously, that show is a cartoon, which makes it more palatable to have characters who are cartoonish. And Homer's rock-headedness is one of its greatest contributions to comedy. But Greg's point was that even something as unimportant as the Overton window for TV characters' personality traits needs to be watched very closely, or things can spiral out of control. In fact, even with good intentions and level heads, if we give in to our lesser instincts too often, there's a far more likely outcome than we become black market weapons dealers. It's simply that we become selfish. We start to believe that our own right to do whatever we want, whenever we want to do it, is more important than anything else, and thus our sense of morality concerns only our own happiness or pain. We become Ayn Rand. Bad writer, worse philosopher. Ayn Rand was a novelist and philosopher who offered her readers the deal of a lifetime. Developing a 19th century idea called rational egoism or rational selfishness, she suggested that the true path to moral and societal progress involves people caring only about their own happiness. She called her theory objectivism, and it's basically the exact opposite of utilitarianism. Instead of trying to maximize pleasure and minimize pain for everyone, we do it only for ourselves. Or, as she wrote in the afterword to her novel Atlas Shrugged,
"My philosophy, in essence, is the concept of man as a heroic being, with his own happiness as the moral purpose of his life, with productive achievement as his noblest activity, and reason as his only absolute."
This is an amazing philosophy, and not in a good way. If our own happiness is the moral purpose of our lives, that means we are obligated to maximize it at the expense of everything else, including, and especially, other people's happiness. In Ayn Rand's world, there could be 1,000 Steves trapped behind that ESPN generator, and I could be the only person watching the World Cup on TV, and I would still decide to let them all fry because I'm happy, and they are merely potential hindrances to my happiness. It's bananas. Here's my favorite quote of hers, wherein she takes a brave stance against the concept of being nice.
"Do not confuse altruism with kindness, goodwill, or respect for the rights of others. The irreducible primary of altruism, the basic absolute, is self-sacrifice, which means self-immolation, self-abnegation, self-denial, self-destruction, which means the self as a standard of evil, the selfless as a standard of the good. Do not hide behind such superficialities as whether you should or should not give a dime to a beggar. That is not the issue. The issue is whether you do or do not have the right to exist without giving him that dime. The issue is whether you must keep buying your life, dime by dime, from any beggar who might choose to approach you. Any man of self-esteem will answer, no. Altruism says yes."
Or, to put it another way, fuck all y'all. It's frankly dispiriting that a woman who advocated radical selfishness and utter disdain for everyone but oneself wasn't booed off the world stage. But even today, Rand has plenty of adherents, especially among those who call themselves libertarians. There are more than a few Randites in the U.S. Congress. Former Speaker of the House Paul Ryan says that he asked all of his staffers to read her books, a request which, based on their length and unreadability, may have violated the Geneva Conventions. I suppose at some level, this shouldn't be surprising, right? She's basically telling her readers that the only thing they need to do to be morally pure is greedily protect their own interests. A diet book that claimed you could lose weight by eating pecan pie and drinking Mountain Dew Code Red would definitely sell a few copies. The appeal of her theories to those interested in achieving and maintaining power is certainly more likely to explain her enduring place than is her actual talent. Rand's novels are endless monstrosities written in turgid prose that doubles as an effective pre-op anesthetic. As one noted academic once put it, quote, "There are only two problems with Ayn Rand. She can't think and she can't write," end quote. It was Todd. Todd said that. The most cursory glance at any of our previously discussed moral theories sends objectivism careening toward the flaming garbage can of history. It's the flat opposite of utilitarianism, so it fails there. I can't imagine Immanuel Kant struggling through 1,172 pages of Atlas Shrugged and declaring infinite selfishness a solid universal maxim. I read the first 220 pages or so to try to understand her theories better, and then I just gave up. I'd rather read Kant's treatise on wind. T.M. Scanlon seems like a pretty calm and thoughtful person, but it's not hard to imagine him reading Ayn Rand and then putting his fist through a wall. And an Aristotelian in search of a golden mean would bristle at a theory that tells the very concept of a golden mean to go jump in a lake. But nonetheless, we live in a world where be as selfish as you can is somehow a mainstream moral theory. It's out there, floating around, telling us we can do whatever we want, ignore the value of others' lives, treat everyone else as a means to our own end, decide that we owe nothing to anyone. I'm almost obligated to point out that at the end of her life, Rand, the self-appointed queen of individualism and unfettered capitalism, applied for and began to collect both Medicare and Social Security benefits. Our little moral transgressions, harmless though they might be, shift our Overton windows ever so slightly toward a world where Ayn Rand's goofy, rational selfishness becomes slightly more plausible. The solution, however, is simple. We commit to these regular check-ins to simply note, when we morally jaywalk, that we're doing it. Make that good deed bank account withdrawal, but pin the receipt up on our cubicle wall as a reminder. The Free-Riding Ninja, a case study. Thinking about the long-term effects of moral calculations we make in small, relatively unimportant moments calls to mind another of philosophy's most famous thought experiments, the free rider problem. Imagine a trolley car, ostensibly a different trolley car than the one with failed brakes that killed all of those construction workers. It's absolutely jam-packed with people. Parents in strollers, cyclists with their bicycles, old couples with a million grocery bags, just a sweaty, soupy reservoir of BO and rush hour misery. Each one of these commuters has paid the required fee to ride the trolley, and miraculously, today, the number of paying passengers is the exact limit of the trolley's capacity. It's amazing how things like that seem to happen in philosophical thought experiments. As the trolley starts to move, a woman named Deb comes running up and jumps onto the outside of the trolley, hanging on to a pole and snagging a free ride. Now, she didn't pay her fare, but she's also not taking up any space that could be used by someone who did. So the question is she doing anything wrong? Instinctively, we think, of course she is. The Kantian whipcrackers immediately point and jump up and down and angrily shout at us in German, since Deb is clearly violating the categorical imperative. Todd suggests that they wouldn't shout, but rather mutter, because they're not angry, they're more disappointed. Whether it's funnier to imagine a German deontologist shouting or muttering, I will leave as an exercise for the reader. This is the kind of exercise for the reader I can get behind. Deb could certainly not will that her action become a universal law. If everyone did what she did, wait until the trolleys are packed and then grab a free ride without paying, the entire commuter system would break down because no one would pay because they'd all be aiming to snag a free ride. It's pretty clearly wrong when you approach it from Kant's perspective. But then again, most things are wrong when you approach them from Kant's perspective. People being wrong was Kant's kink. But no one on the trolley was really inconvenienced. They all got to their destinations in the same amount of time that they would have if Deb had not hitched her free ride. Which means, from a utilitarian point of view, this kind of worked out, right? Deb's sneaky maneuver increased the total amount of happiness in the world. More people got to their destinations without any additional pain. Of course, the smoldering looks of fury directed at Deb from the paying passengers force us to recalculate here. Their combined anger might overwhelm the pleasure of Deb snagging a free trip. So, let's now imagine that Deb is actually hidden from their view. Maybe she scrambled up the side of the trolley car lightning fast and is now lying flat on the roof, unseen by anyone. Deb is a ninja, it turns out. Just go with it. She's a ninja. The question now becomes, if no one sees Deb the ninja commit this small act of rule-breaking, so they were neither inconvenienced by it, nor made to feel any anger about having to live in a world where ninjas get free rides while everyone else has to pay, now what do we think of this action? Is it good? Is it bad? We could keep modifying the original act and chewing on the implications forever. Like the trolley problem, the free rider problem has millions of versions, and maybe even more real-life applications. Once you know it, you see it everywhere. The ethics of not taking a vaccine and thus relying on those who did for personal safety. cheating on your taxes but still using public resources, using too much water on your lawn in a drought-ridden city, not voting but still complaining about the government. These are all free-rider varietals. But in the name of preventing Overton window shifts and descents into Ayn Rand fever dreams of our own worst and most selfish instincts, let's approach this inside out instead of outside in. Let's ask what Deb thinks about what she did. No one else even knows she did it, thanks to her parkour abilities and ninja stealth, so the only one doing any ruminating on Deb's free ride is Deb herself. Is she fine with it? Thinking about Deb's own guilt, or lack thereof, might help us better pinpoint how we feel about making these withdrawals from our moral bank accounts. Deb's feelings about her own action probably depend on a lot of Deb-specific things. Maybe there's context we don't know about. Maybe Deb the free-riding ninja just fought off a group of thugs who were robbing an old man, and then she had to get downtown to meet her sick dad and bring him some soup, and her ninja outfit has no pockets for trolley fare, and she thought to herself, I just did a super good thing, and I'm not hurting anyone here, so I'm just going to grab a free ride. In that case, she's probably acknowledging that this isn't an ideal way to behave, but then letting herself off the hook. Under similar circumstances in the future, she'll pay for her ride, like everyone else. So the Overton window, describing her own moral range, probably won't move very much at all. Or maybe Deb is a bad ninja, not a good one. She walks around all day using her ninja reflexes to steal lollipops from children, and when she saw an opportunity to score a free ride, she literally leaped at it. In that case, Deb might be on a more slippery slope. Her Overton window might have just shifted. Before, her worst actions were petty, candy-related crimes, but now, she's a person who doesn't pay for subway rides and feels no remorse. Deb's absence of guilt may put her on a metaphorical ride to Selfish Town. Again, part of the project of this book is to help us accept failure, because again, failure is the inevitable result of caring about morality and trying to be good people. I really don't mean to argue for perfect living or moral sainthood or anything close to that, because A, it's impossible, and B, I don't even think it's a good goal. Instead, I'm arguing that when we do fail, in matters great or small, we just take a second to acknowledge our failure to ourselves and try to remember that feeling the next time we have a decision to make. That's why it's instructive to focus on something as small as jaywalking or hitching a free ride on a trolley. Deb's actions may have been more justifiable than we thought or less. They may be noticed by other people or go completely unseen. But whatever the case, we can only hope that the little voice in Deb's head chirps loudly enough to keep her from making this a habit, or at least to warn her that she's been doing stuff like this a lot recently, and she ought to knock it off. Small sacrifice, huge reward. It's not always easy to know the difference between harmlessly breaking rules and sending ourselves down a slippery, Overton window-shifting path. Plenty of great TV shows and movies involve people making tiny bad decisions and then spending the rest of their lives making more and more of them to try to make up for the first one, eventually becoming irredeemable monsters. It's unlikely that any of us will, say, decide to start cooking crystal meth like Walter White in Breaking Bad, and then one day find ourselves running a New Mexican drug empire. But if guilt is how we police ourselves, we need to allow ourselves to feel that guilt, and we need to listen to our guilty consciences when they give us pause. That's one of the biggest hindrances to making use of our individual guidance systems. Too many of us just don't pin those slightly damning receipts up on our cubicle walls so they can remind us of these little bad things we've done. Again, I can't help but think about the COVID-19 mask problem. The people who have refused to join the team here, the ones that decided they simply didn't have to or want to follow this new rule, often get extremely indignant when store owners or workers ask them not to be free riders and go maskless while everyone else covers up. How dare you, they say. This is America. I can do what I want because of liberty. And the Constitution guarantees us freedom of face. And also, don't tread on me and George Washington and bald eagles. This is barely a parody. Their arguments were rarely more coherent than that stars and stripes colored word salad. Thanks in part to this attitude, and in larger part to the craven media types and politicians who fostered it, we all watched helplessly as the virus ripped through the country in wave after wave. Even worse were the states where the authorities decided not to require mask wearing, either for similar ideological reasons or because they feared the wrath of those who held that ideology, or both plus ignorance and stupidity. The widespread lack of guilt among mask resistors feels like a real gut punch to me, because again, it's such a minuscule ask. Wearing a mask falls roughly at the don't jaywalk level of individual sacrifice. Imagine we were in that hot day jaywalking scenario from earlier. It's 103 degrees and the crosswalk is a block away, so we intend to just hustle across the street. But now imagine that someone says, "Hey, I know it's annoying, but if we all agree to just head on down and use the crosswalk instead of jaywalking, we can save 100,000 people from dying in car accidents." Imagine how easily we would make that call. Okay, yes, it's a little hot and a little bit inconvenient, but 100,000 people? It would be one of the simplest calculations we'd ever made. And yet here I sit, writing this book, watching the case count for the nation skyrocket because too many people think that their own Ayn Randian right to unfettered selfishness outweighs the sum total of literally everyone else's happiness and safety. It's one of the reasons that Scanlon's What We Owe to Each Other struck such a chord with me. The title itself orients us, points us in a certain direction. He notably did not call his book Do We Owe Things to Each Other? He begins his journey with the point of view that we do, certainly, owe things to each other, and the goal is to find out what those things are. In a fractured national moment of stress and pain, of inequality and injustice, of ethical strain and moral exhaustion, we should go easy on ourselves at moments where we fail in our quest to become better people. But we cannot forget this simple truth. We owe things to each other. They may be small things or simple things, but they're there, they're important, and we can't ignore them. One final PS. After I completed the first draft of this book and sent it to my editor to look over, something started nagging at me. How hard would it be, really, to find a bank that made me feel better about where I keep my money? I had written that all bank CEOs were monsters, but I had focused on maybe the five biggest banks and realized I'd kind of phoned in the actual research. So I poked around and I found a few banks that, in my opinion, were better institutions than the one I'd been using. They don't invest in fossil fuels, they actively support charitable causes, they have codes of ethical conduct for their employees, and so on. Well, crap, I thought. Now I gotta switch. So I did. And after all of my complaining and griping about how hard it would be and how annoying it would be, you know what? It was exactly as annoying as I thought. Maybe more. There was paperwork and confusing phone calls and incorrect routing numbers and new ATM cards and the whole deal. It took months to get things up and running. Now, I'm certainly glad that I did it, but it's important not to sugarcoat how irritated I was at multiple points in the process. It served as a good reminder of two different things. One, the work of making better choices is frequently annoying. We just have to accept that. And two, it can be done if we want to do it and can summon the time and energy to make it happen. We've talked about failure a lot and learning to accept it in our ethical lives, but we can now be a bit more precise when we define which kinds of failure are good and which are bad. The good kind comes from trying to do something good and then either miscalculating or just flatly making the wrong decision. That's the kind of failure that's 100% guaranteed and 100% forgivable. Plus, the attempt at virtue that led to it lets us learn from what we did and gives us a better chance at success in the future. The kind that I was gesturing at when I didn't want to change banks came partly from apathy or maybe moral laziness. I didn't do something that I knew would be a little better than the thing I was doing because, well, it was hard and annoying. We've just spent an entire chapter declaring that perfection is impossible and we're entirely within our rights to let ourselves off the moral hook once in a while when we jaywalk, literally or figuratively. That self-forgiveness is necessary, I think, just to get through the day. But if I'm being honest with myself, I gave up a little early with the checking account thing. I'm lucky enough to even have a checking account and the time and energy to think about the pros and cons of where that checking account is located and the resources to make a change. As we'll see a little later, people in my position have an obligation to fight a little harder to get things right. I don't think I'd be a bad person if I hadn't changed my bank, but I do feel like a slightly better one because I switched, and the initial thing that almost stopped me was more laziness than anything else. We have now completed 2/3 of our journey, everyone. That's the good news. The bad news is we're about to get real thorny. We're going to wade into some deeply confusing and painful applications of moral philosophy, stretching and straining and chewing on really tough questions that plague us in our daily lives, that cause us anxiety and anguish and often lead to loud arguments with our closest friends and family. But in a fun way.
Part 3, in which things get really tough, but we power through and complete our journeys, becoming perfectly virtuous and flourishing and deontologically pure happiness-generating super people. And also, there's a chapter with some cursing in it, but it's for a good reason. Chapter 9. Oh, you bought a new iPhone. That's cool. Did you know that millions of people are starving in South Asia?
In October of 2018, my beloved Boston Red Sox won the World Series, beating the LA Dodgers in 5 games. I was at the title-clinching game in Los Angeles with my close friends Nate and Dave and my son William. I didn't think sports had much more to offer me in the category of emotional gratification, but that moment, the instant they secured the championship, was so pure and wonderful and magical, I felt like I was floating. Dave spontaneously lifted William up in the air. We hugged and cried and laughed and celebrated. In December, I decided to get William a Christmas present to commemorate the occasion, and I found for sale a bat autographed by 4 of the Red Sox's best players. It was pretty expensive for a 10-year-old's Christmas present. $800, yikes. That's almost as much as a new bumper for a 2005 Saab. Sorry, I couldn't help it. But then I scrolled back through the pictures I had taken on that day, and William's face was just so pure and full of joy. So I decided, what the hell? This was a moment we're going to remember forever, and I bought it. And then, for a moment, I felt terrible, and it's all philosophy's fault. Well, one philosopher in particular. The thousands of decisions that we make every day come not just with moral exhaustion, the hot new philosophical term that everyone's talking about, but with a forced accounting of our moral opportunity cost. Opportunity cost is an economics term that describes what we give up when we spend our resources. So the opportunity cost of a company putting more money into research and development is that it can't hire as many workers. The opportunity cost of spending more on advertising is that it has less money to buy supplies. Moral opportunity cost, then, would be the good that we miss out on doing when we choose to do something else. Which brings us to iconoclastic Australian utilitarian and the source of that 2018 buzzkill, Peter Singer. In December of 2006, Singer wrote an article for the New York Times Magazine called "What Should a Billionaire Give and What Should You?" At the time, Bill Gates had pledged nearly $30 billion to his charitable foundation, making him, by the numbers, one of the greatest philanthropists of all time. Singer applauds Gates for his work to eradicate diseases like malaria that ravage poor enclaves of sub-Saharan Africa. But then he says this:
Gates may have given away nearly $30 billion, but that still leaves him sitting at the top of the Forbes list of the richest Americans with $53 billion. His 66,000-square-foot high-tech lakeside estate near Seattle is reportedly worth more than $100 million. Among his possessions is the Lester Codex, the only handwritten book by Leonardo da Vinci still in private hands, for which he paid $30.8 million in 1994. Has Bill Gates done enough? More pointedly, you might ask, if he really believes that all lives have equal value, what is he doing living in such an expensive house and owning a Leonardo Codex? Are there no more lives that could be saved by living more modestly and adding the money thus saved to the amount he has already given?
Singer wants us to think about Gates differently, not as a man who gave $30 billion to charity, but rather as a man who still has $53 billion, none of which he's giving to charity. These numbers were accurate as of the writing of Singer's article. Gates' net worth at the moment I'm writing this has, somewhat absurdly, given the fact that he retired years ago and has given so much away, ballooned to $127.9 billion. The financial impact to him personally in the aftermath of his divorce has yet to be publicized. What would we think of a man who has $53 billion and gives none of it away? We'd start with, what an ass, and probably not move much beyond that. But is that fair to Gates, given, you know, the $30 billion he did give to charity? 4 years later, in 2010, Gates and Warren Buffett announced the Giving Pledge, in which they promised to give at least 50% of their wealth to charity, and they worked to get other billionaires to sign up as well. Buffett has actually pledged that 99% of his wealth will be donated. In Chapter 5, we discussed the upper limits of virtue and discovered the need for some kind of ceiling on what any ethical system can expect of us. But even as we reasonably shrink away from the idea of becoming a happiness pump, Singer doesn't want to let us off the hook. He wants us to think all the time about whether there might be more we can do than whatever it is we're doing to help other people. So now we need to ask a new question. When, if ever, are we allowed to ignore the moral opportunity cost of some mundane, everyday decision? Every pair of loafers is a human life, the Peter Singer story. The people at the top of the human food chain are basically aliens. They live lives we can't possibly imagine. And I say this as an extremely well-paid TV comedy writer. Telecom billionaire John Malone owns more than 2.2 million acres of land in the United States. That means he owns property greater than the size of Delaware, plus all of New York City, plus Houston. Larry Ellison, who founded Oracle Corporation, got bored a few years ago and bought an entire Hawaiian island. The people at the far end of the crazy rich bell curve do not inhabit the same planet as you and I. So on the rare occasion when they emerge from whatever James Bond supervillain volcano they live in and actually interact with the real world, their actions draw intense scrutiny. When wildfires ripped through Australia in 2019, Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, at the time the world's richest man, announced that his company would pledge 1 million Australian dollars, which is about 690,000 US dollars, in aid. For this, he was roundly and appropriately dunked on. People pointed out that Bezos had made that much money every 5 minutes for the entire year. Then, predictably, people began to review what else Bezos had recently spent money on. For example, he had plunked down $42 million to build a clock in a hollowed-out mountain in Texas that was designed to last for 10,000 years. So, $42 million for a weirdo, futuristic alien superclock, $690,000 to save a continent. Barely a month later, Bezos announced he would donate $10 billion over the next decade to fight climate change. It's hard not to see a connection between his public pillorying and his sudden interest in large-scale altruism. See? Shame can be good. It's natural and correct for us to demand that the people who can do the most actually do the most. But what's the most? How much are they on the hook for in any given situation, and when should we feel like they've met their obligations? Singer's critique of Bill Gates' charitable giving shook me up, so I went looking for other stuff he had written, and man oh man, if you are ever interested in feeling morally inadequate, read a bunch of Peter Singer books. His 100% pure, uncut utilitarianism can lead to some weird places, like shrugging off $30 billion in charitable gifts. But he carries one simple idea throughout everything he writes. There is no difference in the inherent value of a life over here, wherever here is for us, than there is in a life over there. To prove his point, he offers a compelling thought experiment, which I will simplify and paraphrase. Imagine that we're walking by a shallow pond and we see a drowning child. Now, most people would agree that we have a moral responsibility to act. We should rush into the knee-high water and, you know, grab the kid so he doesn't, you know, drown. But what if we saw the drowning child and we thought to ourselves, you know, I should save that child, but I just bought these new Italian loafers and I really don't want to ruin them, so good luck, kid. And then we just walked on by, perhaps whistling a happy little ditty about how soft and leathery our loafers are. We would, of course, be considered horrible, awful people, worse even than a guy with $53 billion who gives none of it to charity, probably, because what was required of us was so basic and our reason for not doing it was so callous. Choosing to save our loafers instead of a human being means that we're either sadists or sociopaths or Ayn Rand acolytes or all three. People would tweet about us and drag us for our awfulness, and they would be right to do it. But again, most people aren't monsters. Most of us would instantly calculate that a human life is worth more than a pair of Italian loafers, and we would wade into the pond and try to save the kid. But this is Singer's point. We know for a fact that there are children drowning in ponds, literal and metaphorical, all over the world right now. We see advertisements asking for 30 cents a day to help a starving child in Yemen, or we get mail from an organization telling us that a dollar a week can save a human life in Syria, and more often than not, we ignore them. In fact, we're annoyed by them. But a dollar a week is a lot less than we would have spent on those Italian loafers. So why do we value a life over there less than we value a life over here? Why does the pond have to be literally in front of our faces in order for us to act? When Singer conducts this thought experiment in his classes, students often cite reasonable concerns with the transaction. We would be giving money to an organization that we think is saving lives, but some of it probably gets siphoned off into bureaucracy, and the actual impact of the money is sort of vague. Singer then points out that the cost to us is so small. It's pennies, really. So even if the money is only maybe 25% as impactful as promised, isn't that still a deal worth making? Yeah, I know, it's hard to quibble with, right? And finally, Singer asks us to take the logical next step. Collect all of the money that we were going to spend on Italian loafers or new jeans or a new iPhone we don't really need and send it to someone else somewhere in the world to help that person live a better life, or possibly live at all. He asks us to make a full and complete utilitarian sacrifice. Give up the small amount of pleasure that we get from a new lamp or whatever, and dramatically decrease the amount of pain being felt by someone facing challenges we can hardly imagine. Singer knows he's onto something here. A lot of us buy tons of things we don't need, and the simple act of pointing out how much more we could do with our money spotlights our own excessive consumerism. In fact, when we start looking at all the dumb crap we've accumulated in our houses, all the unnecessary throw pillows and extra sweaters we never wear and $800 autographed baseball bats, we realize that Singer is offering us the deal of a lifetime. We can be heroes. Every single one of us can be Oscar Schindler. Now, granted, Schindler saved lives by risking his own while under the oppressive eye of a fascist regime, and we're just sitting around watching Jurassic Park on TNT and eating honey roasted peanuts, but we can literally save people's lives just like he did. All we have to do is not buy that lamp and instead send the 30 bucks to a mosquito net charity in Africa and then wait for Steven Spielberg to make an Oscar-winning movie about our sacrifice and bravery. But then we remember the cautionary tale of the happiness pump, and we start to wonder where this ends for us, sitting in an empty house down to our last can of honey roasted peanuts. Suddenly, we're back in that gray area, wondering at what point we're allowed to just buy dumb stuff we want and not feel a utilitarian guilt because we aren't using the money for something more important. It's impossible to know. Except, no, it isn't, says Singer, channeling his inner Jeremy Bentham. You can calculate it. Singer believes that there is a certain amount of money that we need for a basic life: food, shelter, a modicum of entertainment or leisure, and so on. That amount varies depending on our circumstances, how many kids we have, where we live, and so on, but it is calculable. We can figure out how much we actually need, build in a little pad for savings and medical emergencies and the like, and any amount of money we make beyond that, we should give to someone less fortunate. The formula is simple, he wrote in another New York Times Magazine article from 1999. Whatever money you're spending on luxuries, not necessities, should be given away. Singer is the consequentialist answer to Immanuel Kant. This dude is hardcore. His view of moral necessity is so intense, I kind of picture him looking like Tom Hardy in Mad Max Fury Road, a post-punk, grizzled, lone wolf utilitarian warrior wandering through the desert guided by an uncompromising sense of justice. In reality, that is not what he looks like. I recommend doing a quick image search and you'll see what I mean. So now we better understand his complaint about Bill Gates. Donating $30 billion is wonderful, but if Gates still has $53 billion, he ought to give almost all of that away, too. I mean, what does Bill Gates not have that he needs? Nothing. But what do famine-stricken children living in Africa not have that they need? Well, beds, houses, food, clean water, malaria medicine, vitamins, education, soap, and vaccines. And what does Bill Gates have that he doesn't need? Around $52.999 billion. For Singer, this is a no-brainer. The amount we have above this calculable necessities total might be $1, or it might be $53 billion, but the action is the same. We don't need it, so we should send it to someone who does. Again, we should point out the very reasonable objections to his command. First, for most people, paying for necessities, adding a bit for entertainment, and saving a little extra for a rainy day doesn't feel very safe. Every one of us will at some point confront a catastrophic black swan type event, a car crash, an illness, a business deal gone wrong, a friend or a relative in extreme need. We also, if we can, want to save for eventual retirement or to help our future kids and maybe grandkids with their lives. If we give all our money away and then suddenly need some for a dire personal situation, we probably won't be comforted by the knowledge that our money was used to deworm a river in Malawi, improving the health of thousands of children. Although some of us would, apparently. There are anecdotes in Singer's books, The Life You Can Save and The Most Good You Can Do, that involve people giving one of their kidneys away. Not to a specific person, mind you, just to whoever needs it, as part of a movement called effective altruism. Singer's acolytes are as hardcore as he is. Part of the calculation that these folks do when donating their kidneys involves the fact that the chances of dying from only having one kidney are roughly 1 in 4,000, basically the same odds as being killed by a car while riding a bicycle. That means, to them, that by not giving their extra kidney away, they are valuing their own lives as 4,000 times more important than the lives of anonymous strangers. Now, despite that mathematical logic, most of us can't help but hesitate at the thought of just giving away a kidney. Most of us have family or close friends for whom we're a theoretical donor. What if our child needed a kidney in a few years, but we couldn't help her because we had already yanked one out to satisfy the dictates of an Australian ethicist we've never met? Or what if our one remaining kidney failed and we were put in the position of having to ask one of our family members to give us a kidney? That's no fun either. The fact that the odds of these things happening are small is irrelevant. The very thought of them gives us chills. Singer, to be fair, acknowledges these sorts of objections when he writes this.
Most of us put our obligations to our family, especially our children, above everything else. Putting the family first feels natural, and in most cases, it seems right.
Another complaint about Singer's worldview is that he's super not into supporting what we might call cultural charities. When kids are literally dying, he says, it's hard to justify ignoring their pain and sending your annual charitable gift to a local art museum or symphony orchestra. Again, it's hard to argue with the logic of that statement, but also, orchestras are nice. For some people, they are incredibly meaningful and vital to their human experience. It seems almost cruel to chastise those people for giving money to the orchestra, using the preventable death of children as a club to bash them with. Now, Singer's point is important and well taken. Some charities are objectively better than others, and the effective altruism movement deserves a ton of credit for researching and highlighting those worthy of our money. For more information, you can see their annually updated list of the most effective charities at givewell.org. But this line of attack can feel like a cousin of my Saab bumper move. You shouldn't care about this thing because that thing is so much worse. Oh, you want to give the art museum $100? That's cool. You could literally save 20 human lives with that money, but no, go ahead. Staring at a Brancusi sculpture is also important, I guess. Singer's arguments can be frustrating in their inflexibility, because again, their basic logic is inescapable, and we find ourselves repeatedly butting up against that logic, even as we feel that it's kind of unfair. That's why, when I bought that expensive but utterly unnecessary autographed bat after the Red Sox won the World Series, I momentarily got bummed out. I felt the specter of Peter Singer glaring at me.
$800 for a bat, huh? Nothing better you could do with that money?
Leave me alone, Peter Singer, I replied, hopefully not out loud, though I can't say definitively whether or not it was out loud. This matters to me. Let me do this. But the specter of Peter Singer was unmoved.
Okay, man, it's your money. But real quick, why don't you head over to Oxfam's website and take a peek at a few stories about people living in abject poverty?
Remember Bernard Williams and his criticism of utilitarianism? He said that it denies us our integrity, our sense of being a whole and undivided person, and it sacrifices our individual core projects in the name of a non-specific mass human happiness. Utilitarianism can sometimes deny us the very things that make us us. Williams would find absurd the idea that I did something morally wrong by buying my son a present celebrating a moment that we lovingly shared and which represents an integral bonding experience. Ultimately, that's where I personally land, too, aligned with Williams and Susan Wolfe, who warned us against seeking moral sainthood. We shouldn't feel bad about filling our lives with experiences and even objects that give those lives shape and dimension. Following Singer's logic, I shouldn't have gone to that game at all, really, because World Series tickets are expensive and that money could be put to better use. We maybe shouldn't have bought nachos and a hot dog for my son. We shouldn't have paid for parking. In fact, I probably shouldn't even pay for the special MLB cable package that lets me watch Red Sox games. It can get very silly very quickly. But Singer, damn it, has a point. We do a lot of dumb stuff that we don't need to do. And when we do that dumb stuff, we very rarely think about the moral opportunity cost, the other, better things we could be doing instead. Singer's unrelenting focus on moral opportunity cost is why I love him, buzzkills and all. His uncompromising utilitarianism serves an important function. In 2019, he re-released his book, The Life You Can Save, and asked me to write an introduction. I had featured the book in an episode of The Good Place. I'm not just philosopher name-dropping again for no reason. I mean, if I did that, my good friend Tim Scanlon would be furious with me. After discussing all of the annoying things a reader can feel while diving into Singer's work, I wrote this. Oh man, this is an entirely new kind of name-dropping. Self-name-dropping. This is a huge breakthrough in name-dropping technology. More important than what you feel when you read this book is what you will not feel, complacency. You will not feel like other people don't matter. You will not blithely scroll past reports of disasters, whether abroad or close to home, without considering, even if just for a moment, the impacted lives of those affected. Instead, you will have, bouncing around in your head, the thought that there may be something simple you can do to help, something that does not disrupt your life or put you or your family's well-being in peril. That, to me, is the gift Singer gives us. It's incredibly easy for people living in even modest comfort to become complacent, to forget that the great majority of people on Earth live in some degree of poverty or distress and have daily problems and dangers that far surpass our own. Air conditioning, heat, food, clean water, a washing machine, a refrigerator, ample electricity, medicine, safety from war or crime, these are things that many of us take for granted and most people can't count on. Singer is like a complacency alert system. Singer, it should be noted, has been criticized for some of his views on disability and the allocation of capital to those with severe health problems, which also come from his stringent utilitarianism and which listeners can probably tease out for themselves. But as we've already learned, it's not always a great idea to follow utilitarian views all the way to their logical ends, whether we're talking about charity or personal use of resources or anything else. Singer is here to tap us on the shoulder, tap, 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 to remind us how fortunate we are and to ask if we might consider doing a bit more to help a few more people. Singer also has plenty of detractors in the academic world. His shoulder tapping doesn't make us feel good, and frankly, it's not supposed to. No one wants to feel like we're constantly screwing up, so when an intimidating Australian road warrior with a sawed-off shotgun, still the way I think of him, can't help it, points out that we can nearly always do more good if we make different choices, who questions our decision-making every single time we go to a movie or buy jeans, well, it kind of sucks. And it's even more painful and annoying to be told that the literal cost of those genes is 10 human lives. However, we also want to be people who care and try, and Singer's shoulder tapping can help with that. The crux of what we're talking about here is, again, engagement. The simple act of asking ourselves, what am I doing? Is there something better I could be doing? Confronting our behavior may be painful and annoying, but it's also a remedy for apathy, which is the enemy of improvement. We can hardly hope to hit an Aristotelian mean of civil engagement if we feel no consequences when we underperform. The COVID-19 crisis led to some inspiring stories, like landlords forgiving rent payments and citizens banding together to deliver food to the elderly and infirm. It also led to awful stories about other landlords evicting people without mercy, and companies forcing their employees to work with inadequate protection. Or, in what I think of as the worst corporate story from this whole awful mess, supervisors in a Tyson Foods factory in Iowa actually placing wagers on how many of their employees would contract the virus. There were fundraisers for frontline healthcare workers and miserable projections of how this would affect the poor and disadvantaged, and through it all, many people wondered the same thing. What are my responsibilities? How much should I do to help? I believe the answer, in this situation and others like it, starts with Scanlon and then drifts over to Singer. When a public health crisis affects everyone on Earth at the same moment, the minimum requirements for all of us, the rules no reasonable person would reject, the basic things we owe to each other, are easy to determine and non-negotiable. We need to limit our travel to the best of our ability, maintain social distancing, wear masks, and so on. After that, and this is where Singer comes back into the picture, our responsibilities scale up depending on our socioeconomic situations. As one example, if we have people who work for us in some capacity, dog walkers, babysitters, and so on, and we can afford to pay them, whether a whole or partial salary, even if they aren't actively working for us during a shutdown, we probably should. In a crisis, people who are lucky enough to have money to spare ought to give it to people who need it. At the top of the food chain, we find people like Jeff Bezos and billionaire media impresario David Geffen, who, given their wealth, I would argue, have the greatest responsibility to help other people, which, when COVID-19 hit, they often did not. Early in the crisis, Amazon started a GoFundMe campaign to raise money for its workers, which went over about as well as it had when Bezos tossed $690,000 at Australia to help fight their wildfires. There was some confusion about whether Amazon was actually soliciting donations from the public. They themselves funded the campaign with $25 million, and a spokesperson later denied that they wanted the public to contribute. But then one would wonder, why start a GoFundMe campaign at all? A basic calculation shows that Bezos could personally pay all of his 250,000 minimum wage employees their full yearly salaries and still have about $175 billion left over. When you are the world's richest man and you employ hundreds of thousands of people who are in harm's way, your responsibilities extend far beyond paying your dog walker. Geffen, not to be outdone, at one point posted an Instagram photo of his $590 million yacht sailing peacefully in the Grenadines, along with an unironic caption about the importance of social distancing. If you're wondering how that went over, he very quickly set his account to private, and as of this writing, hasn't really been heard from since. I'm not quite as harsh regarding Geffen as Peter Singer would be. I wouldn't say he's morally required to sell his yacht and donate the money. But I would say that as a man worth billions, he has a responsibility to do far more than the average person during a pandemic that disrupted the lives of everyone on Earth. I would also recommend he spend some of that money on a social media consultant so that when he tries to post a picture of his $590 million yacht in the same week that a record number of Americans lose their jobs, there would be someone to grab his phone